Welcome to The Book Show, and this week we come to you from Charlie Burns Bookshop in Galway, where we're here for the Kirch International Festival of Literature. We'll be chatting to Patrick DeWitt and Sarah Maria Griffin at the festival. But first, Kirsty Logan's debut novel, The Grace Keepers, is set in a watery future where the Damplings and the Landlockers compete for resources.
The Grace Keepers is set in a flooded world, so all that remains of the land is a very few small scattered archipelagos, and almost everybody has to live on boats which travel between the islands, providing different services for the rich people who live on the islands. The first Callanish knew of the Circus Excalibur was the striped silk of their sails against the grey sky. They approached her tiny island in convoy. The main boat, with its bobbing trail of canvas-covered coracles, following like ducklings, chained in an obedient line. Ships arrived a dozen a day in the archipelagos, and Callanish knew that the circus folk would have to fight for their place on her island. In a world that's almost entirely sea, placing your feet on land was a privilege that must be earned.
And Kirsty Logan there giving us a taster of The Grace Keepers. She joins us now to have a chat about the book. Hi, Kirsty.
Hello.
Can we start with the dynamic between the two groups of people in this book? We meet the Damplings, who've been relegated to the sea, and the Landlockers, who live on land. And what's going on between them? Because there's a lot going on. There's issues of class, and there's all sorts of things going on. But tell me more.
Well, although it's a very fantastical and otherworldly kind of book, I did want it to reflect the reality of the world that I live in. And at the time that I was writing it, and unfortunately still now not much has changed, there is a huge class divide and an economic divide between people who can afford to buy property, particularly in Scotland where I live. It's a huge issue. Nobody can afford to buy anywhere to live, essentially, where my generation is a generation of renters. So although I wanted to write this kind of magical, fantastical, beautiful story, I did end up coming down to economics, because I think that's the world that we live in. Economics are important whether we think about it or not. So just in me trying to explore the world that I live in and to try and convert it to this magical other world, of course these class and economic issues and political issues did seep into the story.
Tell me about North and the circus in which he performs.
So the circus is quite a rundown circus. That's always fascinated me. I love glitz and glamour and showbiz and burlesque and circuses. But then I'm also fascinated by the underside of that, because I think anytime something is very glitzy and glamorous, it makes me think, but what's underneath that? Because nothing is just glamorous by itself. There's always a dark side to that. So that's why I wanted to make the circus quite a struggling circus, a rundown circus. The North and her fellow circus crew, they never have enough. There's never enough food, never enough space, never enough of anything. They can never quite have comfort or contentment. So although it is a circus and it's very glamorous, there's a very difficult and dark side to that as well.
Now, the other character we meet is Callanish, and she's a grace keeper. Which is where the title of the book comes from. But what is this act of grace keeping?
So because the world is flooded, when people die, they can't be buried in the ground as we generally do now. Instead, they're sunk into the sea, and above them is floated a bird in a cage, and the bird is called a grace. And the lifespan of the bird marks the period of mourning for the person who has died. So Callanish's job as the grace keeper is to look after these dying birds. She lives this very isolated existence just in the middle of the ocean, surrounded by all these cages of dying birds with bodies below them, which is, you know, a very sinister and isolated kind of life. And in the world, it's seen as almost holy, but it's kind of a penitence as well. So a lot of people are given this work to do, but she has chosen it for a terrible thing which she did, which I will not spoil because you will learn that in the book.
When these burials take place, there are birds left in cages on the surface. So why did the population settle on those birds as a symbol of the funeral and the burial?
The reason I decided to use birds was actually a very personal reason, and that's where the entire book came from, which was that I lost my father very suddenly when I was 27, and he was only 58, and he died very suddenly, and I was really struggling a lot with grief, and I wasn't brought up with any kind of religion, so I didn't have any formal mourning. And my partner is Catholic, and I really envied her that more formal grieving procedure because I didn't have anything like that. And one day, about a year after my dad had died, I was out on a boat and I saw a life buoy in a cage that looked like a birdcage. So just daydreaming, I started to think, why would there be a birdcage in the sea? And the entire idea of the book just came from there. So that's why it's birds. But also birds throughout history are quite often associated with death or remembrance or letting go of things. So I thought they were quite a good symbol, also because the world is flooded. Really, birds are the only things, I guess, apart from fish, who can have any kind of freedom of movement.
You create for us this water world, this flooded world that you speak of, but you don't tell us that much about why we're in this place. We were just dropped right in. Why did you do it that way, and why not give us a backstory?
I think I wanted it to be a very character-based story. I didn't want to write a polemic. I didn't want to bash people over the head with my environmental politics or my economic politics or anything like that. I wanted to tell a very character-based story. And I think the characters wouldn't think about it. So, for example, we go through life, we go through every day. And I don't know about you, but I don't often think about what happened hundreds of years ago to make the landscape the way that it is, or to make our culture the way that it is. You just get on with your life. You're just trying to survive day by day, trying to be happy, trying to be safe, trying to have some fun. So that's what these characters are doing. And I don't think that they would necessarily spend a huge amount of time thinking about the catastrophe that made the world this way, because I just don't think people do.
Is there also more scope for drama, perhaps, if you, you know, focus on the struggle to survive?
You're absolutely right. I think we tend to live in the today. We tend to live for now and focus on the problems and the issues of our lives in the moment. We don't tend to look back so much and think about what happened yesterday, what happened a generation ago, what happened 100 years ago. So I just wanted to focus on these characters and on their daily lives and on their specific struggles, personal issues, them dealing with who they are as people and how they've come to be this way and how they can move forward from there.
If these characters and this book doesn't look back, it does in a way look forward. And one of the ways it does that, and that there's a lot of talk about mothers and daughters and pregnancy, and that would suggest focusing on the next generation, how they're going to survive, what's going to happen next.
Absolutely. And one of the main characters is pregnant, which is not a spoiler. That's revealed very early on. So North is pregnant, and there's a little bit of a mystery of who the child's father is. So, of course, she's always thinking about the future because she's very aware that her child is coming soon, and she wants the world that her child is born into to not be the exact world that she lives in. She wants her child to have a better life than the one that she has had. So in that way, she's forced to always look forward. And similarly with Callanish, she's very much stuck in a limbo. She's always looking back. She's always giving herself this terrible time for this thing that she's done in the past. And it's only when she meets North that she can then begin to look forward.
When Callanish and North do actually meet, and they both have a sense of loneliness and isolation, I guess, in their own lives, but they have a connection. And yet, in the book, they don't spend that much time together.
Yes, the book is very much them journeying to be together, not just crossing physical distances, which of course North does because she's constantly on the move, being on her boat, but it's them trying to get their lives in order so that they can be together. Although they don't necessarily know that at the time, they just know that they want to move forward and make a change, and they're readying their lives in order to, so that when they meet again, things are different and they are different as people.
You shouldn't always resist where ideas come from, even if they come from a place, as you mentioned, your father's passing, and yet a tiny gift came out of that, a great idea, which has formed the basis of your book. So in terms of inspiration, it can literally be somewhere where you don't expect to find it.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's lightness even in the darkest times. And I've quite often thought, ever since all this has happened, I wish my dad could see this. I wish that he could see this book and the readers and the feedback that I've got from it and all the things that have happened. But then at the same time, I would never have written this book if he was still alive. There's a real bittersweetness because, of course, I would give anything if I could see him again and he could see how well everything is going and I could talk to him again. But at the same time, so much has happened because I lost him. And I think it really changed me as a person. It changed me as a writer. And so much of the learning and changing that I've done in the past few years has been because I've lost him. So, yeah, I'm just hoping that part of the reason that I wrote this book was to try and give some comfort to someone who is also in a difficult situation. And I've noticed that I get a lot of email and people coming up to me at events and things saying that they're going through a difficult time. Maybe they've lost a loved one. There are people who've lost fathers or children, people who are going through hard times with medical issues or anything like that. And they're saying that the book has helped them in some way, which is really the reason I wrote it in the first place, was because I was going through a difficult time, so to help other people who were also going through difficult times.
There is a sense, I guess, that, you know, we know that books and music and film can be, you know, quite redemptive and that they can help us. Even in the future, even if it's going to be very dire in this book, do you think that we'll always place a value on art and performance? Because the circus is at the heart of this book as well.
I love that you chose the word redemptive because, of course, the birds in the book are called graces, and I've always been really fascinated by the concept of grace and how do we find grace and what does it mean to different people. You know, I was not brought up with religion, but just this concept has always fascinated me ever since I was a child. So that is something that I wanted to explore, like how do we live a good life and where's the meaning in life? And I think, however dark things get, we will always use the arts and literature, music, films to explore emotions, to explore difficult emotions and to reflect the world around us.
Kirsty Logan, thank you so much. The Grace Keepers is published by Harville Secker. Now, Sarah Maria Griffin's first book, Not Lost, was a memoir of her time in San Francisco. Sarah is here at the Kirch Festival this week and has written this short piece for the book show on stress and sleep.
The first time it happened, I was on a midday bus from Dublin to Galway, call it sometime in 2010. The bus was empty, so I kicked off my sneakers and put my knees up to my chin and leant across both seats to sleep. Many of my cross-country voyages that year were upright, tense, too close to a stranger to relax. I don't remember falling asleep there in the gentle hum of the journey, but when I came to, I was paralysed. The deadening sensation of unconsciousness was still in my arms, my legs, the muscles in my face, but my heart beat hard and loud as though on an escape mission. My mind was very much awake, convinced that this strange upright position, almost fetal, was how the paramedics would retrieve my body from the bus, carry me into the ambulance, dead, obviously dead, while I couldn't tell them I was still there, beneath a thick, stupid coat of flesh and bone. I imagined myself buried. Nope. This was not how I was going to be found, under no circumstances. I would shake this weird mystery off of myself. My eyes were open. I could kind of move my tongue, heavy in my mouth. I focused extremely hard on wiggling my toes. Stretch by stretch, my body woke itself. Through some strange haze of chemical sleep, my heart battering its way out of me now with relief, rather than terror. A cursory Google named this strange thing sleep paralysis, a common physiological phenomenon during which the sleeper's brain wakes up before their body, or their body goes asleep before their brain. Shh now. You aren't possessed or terminally ill. It happens to just about everyone once or twice in their lifetime. A spooky little badge of honour. Let me tell you about the time. No more than this, surely. In 2015, from a sunny week in July right through to December, I had sleep paralysis almost every single night. I would lie in the bed and feel my body give way, deaden below me as my consciousness swam, my heart still thundering the same get me out as it did on that bus, someplace between Athlone and the West Coast. in a bed in Lisbon, sun-kissed and wine-soft, it began and it did not stop, night after night after night. During this period, I was finishing my first novel, under revolving and intense deadlines, a mad luxury, this, for which some part of my head wasn't quite ready. The part of my head, I am assuming, is the one that lets me sleep. Funny how we acclimatise to things, how our bodies both rebel and settle within strange routines and circumstances. The world without sleep grew slippery around me. Information somehow more difficult to retain.
Time more textured.
Weight silently left my body. Light felt different. Time more textured. 4.
Sleep.
5.
Sleep.
6 a.m.
Sleep.
Body frozen and unfrozen. Perhaps catch 2 hours of something like sleep. Get up again.
Get up again.
Get back to the work at hand.
Get back to the work at hand. Drink coffee.
Drink coffee. Tremble under false awakeness. How shallow the caffeine hit. Try not to smoke any cigarettes. Lie down to sleep and wait for it to happen. Wait for the deadening to come.
Wait for it to happen.
Conquer it. Hold the sleeping hours like precious gold until they eventually, months later, multiply into a healthy rest. I had safe passage from the curse of it from December until February when the manuscript was out of my hands. Then, in Galway again, escaping Dublin for a night to haunt that sailor's knot of a city, I lay in the starched white of a rented bed, my partner snoring beside me, port drunk and happy. There it was again. Outside, a cluster of students drank buckfast and sang, legs dangling right where the Carib splits, swan-dappled into ocean. My chest is heavy. My arms are not my own. Their bottles clink and their laughter is fountain. I am paralyzed. I am alive.
And thanks to Sarah Maria Griffin. Her debut novel, Spare and Found Parts, is in the pipeline, so keep an eye out. Now, we're still here in Charlie Burns' bookshop and we're joined by Patrick DeWitt, who was nominated for the Man Booker Prize for his novel, The Sisters Brothers. His new novel is Under Major Domo Minor. So, Patrick, who or what is that?
The Under Major is the underling to the Major Domo, a man named Mr. Olderglow. And the under major in question, his last name is Minor, hence the title Under Major Domo Minor. Under Major Domo, by the way, is an invented word. I looked it up after the fact, wondering what a major domo's underling was called, and it's actually the minor domo. But I found that out too late.
The underling at the start of this book is a young teenager called Lucy, who is a boy and not a girl, and he goes to this mysterious castle at the foot of a mountain. So who is he and what is he looking for? Why is he there?
Well, he is there. A friendly priest in his hometown village has gotten him a job there as the under major domo. And he is 17 and he's an unpopular lad in his village and he can't find a girlfriend or friends. And he's a bit of a liar and a weakling, and he's just looking for, as he says in his own words at the beginning of the book, just something to happen. So this job represents that something.
What's Mr. Olderglow's role in the story? Is he just a bit of a distraction, or does he need to exist in order for Lucy to go on this journey?
Well, he was one of these mysterious characters that pops up. He was meant to be very much a minor character in the background, but as soon as he and Lucy began to speak to one another, they had a real rapport. And it seemed like there was something worthwhile in experimenting with it and getting to the root of it. So his role became much larger as the book went on. But he's somebody who is the far opposite of Lucy. He's sort of a decrepit older man who hasn't delivered very much for him in the way of adventure or romance. And so he spends most of his days sort of sitting around and opining about all the things that he wished he could have done.
Well, to get a sense of the world and the characters and definitely of Lucy, you're going to read a bit for us, Patrick, but tell us what's happening here.
Okay, this is the section where Lucy is spying with the telescope on his boss, the Baron. And the Baron is a sort of lovelorn and miserable individual. The Baroness is missing in action, but she's coming back just now. And he's watching the Baron as the Baron is sort of preparing for the return of his true love. On the evening prior to the Baroness's arrival, Lucy watched from his window as the Baron roamed about in the field separating the castle and village. He walked for long moments with a still face, his hands behind his back, but then began murmuring to himself, then speaking, and with increased animation, gesturing this way and that, a sly smile on his face. Lucy recognized that the Baron was imagining he was with the Baroness and practicing the things he would say to her. At one point he drew his hand to his mouth, searching for some suitably clever phrase, perhaps. Upon locating it, then giving voice to it, his eyes grew bright with pleasure. Lucy found a commiserative affinity for the man growing in his heart, and was made apprehensive by the fact. For if love had so degraded a personage of the Baron's powers, what might it do to him? Folding up his telescope, he pushed the thought from his mind. It was too unsettling to regard directly.
And that was Patrick DeWitt reading there from Under Major Domo Minor. Patrick, the book has a very fable-like, very fairy tale quality. So why fables?
Yes, I was started off, the jumping off point for this book was the fact of my reading fables, Central European and Eastern European fables to my son, who was 7 at the time. And I was working on a different sort of a book, which I was losing interest in. And as this book was slipping away from me, I remember feeling a sort of an envy of the people that had written these other stories that I was reading to my boy. It seemed like a bit more fun, so I jumped ship.
One of the things I like about Lucy that I found so entertaining is that he's a pretty formidable liar. And he says at one point, how remarkable a thing a lie is. He wondered if it weren't man's finest achievement, and after some consideration, decided that it was. Isn't lying what fiction writers do to a certain extent?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's exactly what we do. So yeah, I felt an empathy and an affinity for Lucy's desire to tell lies.
Because people like telling lies.
People like to tell lies. People like to hear lies. They like to retell other people's lies. You know, it is one of the primary currencies of our society.
Tell me about your son in line.
Oh yeah, there is a moment in writing this book, or maybe it was preceding the writing of this book. At a certain point, my son discovered lying at 7 or 8 or something like this. And he was lying about things that he knew he would be caught. You know, he knew it was like this sort of kamikaze lie that he would tell over and over again at any sort of silly thing that came into his mind. And he was drunk with the power of lies. And I asked him to stop it and that it was being silly. And if he was going to lie, maybe he should lie about something more relatable or realistic, or, you know, these lies that are just, he knows he's going to be caught. Maybe we should put an end to that. And he said something along the lines of, I know I shouldn't lie, and I'm trying not to, but it just feels so good. And I understood that, and I had a great sympathy for him.
I know that you've spoken before about the fact that you were working on another book before, Under Major Domo Minor. So at what point and what made you ditch that book, and how hard is it to throw something away that you've slogged on?
It depends on how much slogging has occurred. With that book, quite a lot had occurred, and I'd done trips to New York, and I had moved to Paris to research it and sold my car and everything. So it was a bitter pill to lose that book, but it's also a great relief. You know, it's like quitting a job. You know, you need a job, but there's other jobs out there. And when you quit a job that isn't suited to your personality, you can feel whatever fear is there. I find that the sense of triumph overrides all the other negative feelings. So it took me a number of weeks, I suppose months maybe, in Paris to recognize that book was not going to go the distance. But once I addressed it and began to verbalize to friends and everything, that book is dead now. It's a good feeling. So it's not that hard to do, you know. It takes some time, but you can't really cling to it. And I'm not one of those writers who insists on finishing a thing. If I recognize that it's fundamentally flawed, I don't lament the lost time, because it's not really lost time, even if you lose a book I was writing all those days. So I'm at least staying in shape, if nothing else.
Tell me about the book you're working on.
What can I say about it? I've been trying to describe it to friends and failing miserably. It's a contemporary story of a wealthy mother who's late middle-aged, and she has an adult son. And they've got a extremely close relationship, some would say strangely close. They've created a world where it's just the two of them, and it's sort of a united front of them against the world. And they look askance, basically, at everyone who is not them. It's a very dialogue-rich book. It's about class. They're wealthy, at least in the beginning of the book they are. It takes place partly in New York and partly in Paris. So some of that studying I did in those two cities, I'll be able to utilize in a different book. So it wasn't a dead loss, all that travel.
Thanks so much, Patrick DeWitt. And Patrick DeWitt's Under Major Domo Minor is published by Granta.
Well, that's all from us here in Galway. Thanks so much to Charlie Burns Bookshop and to the Kirch International Festival of Literature. The production team is Regan Hutchins and Zoe Cummins. See you back in studio next week.